greetings, welcome to the Dividing Line. Can't see anything up on the screen there, but doesn't probably really matter because I landed. There we go. About 14 and a half hours ago, something like that. Or is that when I got home? I don't know. Anyway, back from the land down under and the jet lag issues. I'm feeling pretty good today, thanks to a certain person in Melbourne who remain nameless. People ask, is it harder for you to go east or west? And to be honest with you, going to Europe or coming back from South Africa and stuff like that, coming back, you gain so much time that it does seem to be easier than going the other direction. But Australia is just weird. You're in a different season. Everything on the continent wants to kill you. And the whole time I was there, it was sort of like I was 6 hours behind everything, but I was actually 18 hours ahead of everything. So functionally, you're 6 hours behind, but, you know, like you're doing stuff on Monday and people are complaining that you're violating the Sabbath or something because they don't realize it's Monday where you are. So, yeah, it's very, very different. And so coming back from there, first day back normally isn't the worst. I got home. I stayed up till my wife got up to go to work. She gets up at 2:30 in the morning, 2:20. So I stayed up because that was only 8:30 at night as far as I was concerned. So, but she's on a trip now. So if I hadn't stayed up, I would not have seen her for like over 3 weeks. So I decided, nah, we'll stay up. And so here we are. So that means I do get a mulligan for any misspeaking today, okay? I know I won't be granted that by anybody, but you know, if I get one reference wrong today, it won't matter if I've written an entire book that had everything right. It's the one reference you get wrong on the day after you barely 12 hours after you get back from a 14-hour transcontinental flight, and then of course trans-Pacific flight, and then the worst part was I landed in LAX. That is a third world airport. It is horrible. Oh my goodness. They stuck us out of the stand. We're on a 787 Dreamliner. That's a nice plane. Really is a nice plane, by the way. If you've got a choice between any other airplane and that one on a long haul, take the 787. You will feel so much better. Air's humidified, higher pressure, HEPA filters. It's a modern aircraft. You can't always get one, but this was my big test flight. How good do you feel when you get off the plane? You didn't feel like you had, it's a long story. Anyways, get a 787. They put us at a stand, stick us on buses after we get off the plane, make us wait for them to do that, and then drive us around LAX for 10 minutes, going around corners, all the rest of the stuff. After 14 hours, you're going around in this car and then finally get to where you have to go. Customs, claim all your bags. So now you're dragging all your bags uphill. They make you go up this hill. There are no functioning walkways in LAX. None. I had to walk from Terminal 4 to Terminal 7. Not a single moving walkway. There were two broken escalators. So you had to take your luggage apart, down the escalator. Oh, it was Lusaka's airport in Zambia is much better than LAX. It really is. It's just like, woohoo! LAX, what a fun thing that is. Anyhow, so yeah, that's where we are today, and that's everything else on the trip was great. Really was. The flight over, even LAX on the way over, because I didn't have to move any terminals, was fine. But the last part, where you're the most tired, and it's like, patience, have to have patience. Anyways, so we're home, and we've got ReformCon this week, and we're going to we're trying to work out how we're going to do this mashup thing with Apologia Radio and Dividing Line. We're going to put it together and do something from ReformCon. Summer's coming down. She's going to be speaking. We'll probably drag her into the middle of that too, as long as she's there. I don't know what's going to happen, but It'll be a lot of fun, one way or the other. It'll be very, very interesting, especially in light of what happened. Man, when I'm gone, everything starts going crazy. I mean, right the I think right as I left, somebody pulled a gun on one of our guys, but he wasn't wearing his GoPro. And then just a few days later, Elvis Kesto gets the abortion doctor pulling a gun at him, and the police are like, we can't tell that's the gun. That poor officer that obviously was told by his higher ups, now we're not doing anything about that, is now famous for going, I don't know if that's a gun. What?
You know what they should have done is get the meme from the guy in the 2000, the Gore, looking at the Chads.
Oh, yeah. No, they did. The one of the memes is Elvis pointing the officer to something, and over in the next panel, they have free eye exams for Phoenix police officers. Look, the fact of the matter is, if Apologia did not have the web presence that it does, and they had not put that video together and put it out there so that all the people with common sense could look at it and start calling the Phoenix Police Department, nothing would have ever happened. They would have gotten away with it because Planned Parenthood owns the government. Oh, yeah, local media, yeah, you know, but, you know, for most folks, they would have gotten away with it, So all that happens, and I'm safely ensconced down under, and got no idea what's going on, and Jeff and the guys are too busy to even pop anything into our little WhatsApp group, so I'm just sort of like, guys, what's going on back there, you know? that's just the way it is. And again, you can either say I had an 18-hour head start on everything, or I was just always 6 hours behind. And what it feels like is you're always 6 hours behind. That's pretty much how that works. I just found a meme on Reform James White memes for 16A19's opponent says something historically naive, and it's a picture of Lee Baker holding up his King James Bible with all his markings in it and stuff like that. And Jason's looking at it rather, I don't know. And then the next one is my response. And I can tell by the look on my face, I'm going, you just said what? And Jason is literally facepalming. I mean, I just saw this right as the program was starting. I haven't had a chance to watch that. I don't know that I will. I probably will because Sean McCraney put out a video when I was still in Sydney before I went down to Melbourne, and talking about how he's going to put out a video and he's going to do a much better job than I did responding to Lee Baker, but then made it very clear he actually hadn't watched the debate. So how do you know? Well, I talk to people. Good. And then his description is that there were tears and I shut down Jason and pure fiction. I mean, fantasy land. That's all it was. And, you know, that's just Sean. Sean just lives in his own fantasy world. And so, you know, he went after Jeff and I. So, you know, Jeff and I are going to Salt Lake City. Hey, Sean, Jeff and I will come on together. If you can prove that Calvinism is so bad and the Trinity and all the things you accuse us of, well, come on. And he's like, I'm not both of you at the same time. Well, why not? More the merrier, right? I mean, if you're just this great prophet of the future. So anyways, I'm going to be responding to that. I didn't get a chance to respond to his email where he just basically admitted he lives in fantasy land, but I'll get to it later on. So yeah, here we are. So much to talk about. I guess I'll go ahead and talk about something that happened before I get to the trip itself. Cause that was, I mean, two debates and all sorts of neat stuff down there in the land down under. But, yeah, I started telling everybody down there that, John MacArthur broke the internet by saying two words. And the problem was, the two words were taken out of context, but were spoken in a particular context as well. And specifically, let's just remember, I think that Todd Friel invented the word snark. If he didn't, he was one of the first ones to use it. But he may have actually invented it. But I think probably the first place I ever heard anybody use it was Todd Friel. I mean that quite seriously. And so he is the very definition of snark. His entire shtick is snark. And so you have to put that in context and remember that it was in a Q&A with him that MacArthur used the term, was it disqualified? I think he was disqualified in regards to Stephen Furtick, who then wrote an entire book called Disqualified in response to it. And they even mentioned that. So when Todd starts off going, okay, word identification, you know, most sane people are running off the stage at that point. The rest of us are tied down, and we know how sad Todd looks when he's rejected and unloved. So we just can't put up with it. So we stay there and put up with whatever happens. But most people want to run because you know you're going to be asked a question in the least comfortable possible way. I normally just ignore what the question is and say something useful. That's how I do it, and he can't stop me, so it's just the way it is. But Dr. MacArthur even said, I'm being set up, and he was, in a sense. But when Beth Moore's name was stated, and there was all this laughter, that's one of the things that's been turned into, oh, this was just so hateful. If you were in that room, I was not. If you were in that room, and you have Todd Friel up there, and Todd Friel starts like that, everyone's going to laugh because you just know that's Todd Friel. There wasn't anything misogynistic about that. I could not believe that there were people actually using the term misogyny. Well, I can believe it because they're woke. Their ultimate authority is critical theory and intersectionality and all this silliness. And so they're full on board with the use the weaponized words, transphobia, homophobia, misogyny. These are weapon words. They are words that are meant to communicate pure negativity without actually having any truth content in and of themselves. Because anyone who argues that John MacArthur hates women because he doesn't believe that Beth Moore should be preaching to men for more than just the fact of her gender, the content of her books, the content of her tweets, the content, I mean, about three days earlier, is really close at the same time. I started seeing all this stuff in my feed about, do you want to make a snowman? And I'm sitting here thinking, did Clementine take over the internet? You know, because I remember Clementine's Frozen period, you know, where everything was Elsa and all that kind of stuff. And so I had to, do you want to build a snowman? You know, it's stuck. It you hear it so many times. It's in the background, foreground, it's everywhere. It gets stuck in your brain. And then, of course, Clementine's debate with Jeff Durbin about Frozen, which Clementine won by a long shot. Wasn't even close. Jeff has improved a lot since his debate with Clementine. He was really good in our debate up there in Salt Lake, but Clementine crushed him. We're still not sure whether he has a chin or not, but that's a completely other issue. I started seeing all this stuff, and then lo and behold, here's this stuff about Beth Moore talking about playing with Jesus, and they built a snowman together or something. I'm just like, okay, so there's a lot more behind John MacArthur's statement than just the fact that she's a woman. But that was the main thing, because I don't think Dr. MacArthur has spent much time reading any of Beth Moore's books. Or I can guarantee you he does not do her Twitter feed. No, that's not happening. So all this stuff is happening, and he makes the statement. And then later on, he expands in the same clip. He says, you know, let me add, there is absolutely no argument for women preachers and so on. He's just making a standard statement that would have caused everyone in the 1970s to go, why are you even saying this? Not everyone, but everyone in our circles anyways, to say, why are you even saying this? What's going on here? Things have changed. And then Phil, of course, His one-word response was narcissistic. If he had just stopped there and had not said what he then said afterwards, which was specifically that every time he listens to Beth Moore, she is seeking to insert herself into the biblical narrative. And you know what? As I think back, I don't listen to much Beth Moore. Most of the time when I've seen something, it's been the hair combing thing, or just today was her tweet, which she's blocked me, but this tweet where she's talking about this conversation with Jesus, you know, and Jesus is, you know, how's your day going, Beth? Well, I'm having a tough day. Would you like me to change it for you, Beth? I mean, it is the essence of Jesus as my boyfriend, girlfriend type stuff. And that is what I've seen. And what Phil said was she's always trying to read herself in the biblical narrative. That's narcissistic. To make it sound like Jesus's highest priority in the universe today is how Beth Moore is feeling because she's stressed out this morning, is a problem. It sort of goes along with another tweet that I saw from another woke individual that was talking about what the fear of God means. And by the time they got done talking, it was a whole long Twitter thing. Not a single lexical source was cited, of course. Because as I said somewhere else on Twitter this morning, or actually it was on our website, it was Facebook and then website and Twitter and stuff like that. As my Greek professor long ago, and I have reminded him of this a number of times, said, now the Greek word fear means fear. It was in a Life and Letters of Paul class, and I was the only person who was still conscious at that point. But I remember it very clearly, and he happens to be right. And so there is this fear of the Lord that nowhere appeared in any of these discussions. And the sappy sentimentality of this kind of stuff requires you to put yourself in the center. I am the most important person in the world to God. And there are songs like that. There are contemporary Christian songs like that. You just want to go, oh. The God-centeredness, gone. Man-centeredness, everywhere. I'm not saying all CCM is like that. Don't get me wrong. There's some good stuff out there. But Phil went on to explain that's what he meant. And, of course, that was considered to be misogynistic and all the rest of this stuff. And remember, these are the same people that think that that Bible translation committees have to be diverse. That you have to have a certain number of minorities and a certain number of women and a certain number. Who knows? Pretty soon it'll be transgenders and all the rest of the stuff to get all the proper voices. Rather than, you know, we just want to have the absolute best people who know translation. They know Greek and Hebrew and they know English and they know all the things you need to know to do a good job with this. Nah, that's not our concern. So the internet gets broken. Unfortunately. I have not seen any response to this yet, but I have attempted a couple of times now to get people to focus upon, look, there's, to the people who would identify as being on my side, whatever that might be, you need to remember something. There are certain subjects, there are two subjects that I'll mention that conservatives assume rather than prove. They assume them rather than prove them. I mentioned one of them at the end of the Q&A in Melbourne on Sunday evening. And that is the issue of the nature of eternal punishment. It is assumed, but in my experience, the vast majority of people don't know why they assume it, and they figure everyone believes like they do. And as a result, most people aren't able to interact much when challenged in that particular area, because it is accepted because it's assumed rather than studied. And there are certain fundamental underlying assumptions, such as you cease sinning when you die. Somehow you become regenerate and you no longer sin. Certain issues like that that need to be recognized and understood that just aren't a general part of the conversation. And the other is the horrifically named complementarian egalitarian. Is there any other dispute in the church that has worse marketing, tagging, naming than that? You can't even say that three times fast without speaking tongues. It's horrible. But that particular, you know, if you are not aware of the fact that, for example, in the Timothy passage, 2:12, that the verb that is used there is argued by egalitarians. Why don't you do that right, 2 Timothy? 1 Timothy. Get the right number. I can't type today. It's one thing. But I do not allow them to teach or exercise authority over man, but to remain quiet. Alphantine is the term that is used there. And Loanita define it as to control in a domineering manner. So to control a domineering manner is often expressed idiomatically, for example, to shout order that, to act like a chief toward, to bark at. That's Loanita. If you look at BDAG, to assume a stance of independent authority, give orders to, dictate. So that's a little less, Loanita can have spin in some of the things that it says. But BDAG is a little better. To assume a stance of independent authority. So as they see it's independent authority. So what they will argue is that Alphantine in 1 Timothy 2:12 is an inordinate claim of authority. So this guy on Twitter today, he hasn't responded to me because I've asked for some documentation. But this guy was saying that there was a single woman who had inserted herself improperly into the leadership of the church in Ephesus. And that this is just a single historical context, and Timothy's there, and so Paul's only dealing with that. Okay? So, if you're not familiar with the arguments and usages of Alphantine, and if you aren't up on, well, you know, what about Corinthians? I mean, there were women prophesying in Corinth, and what's that about? Then you're assuming stuff and just throwing that stuff out and saying, well, see, Paul's on my side. There's always another side. And if you haven't listened to the other side and know how to respond to it, be careful how bold you are in throwing your arguments out. These are two areas where that's exactly what ends up happening. So what I've done, and nobody cares, I haven't seen anybody pick up on it, so I seem to be the only person, even raising the issue. But my simple question is, you say you believe in sola scriptura. A lot of them don't. I mean, one of the first things you abandon when you start going woke, going liberal, going left, is sola scriptura, because you no longer believe that it's actually sufficient. But if you say you believe in it, which any Southern Baptist has to say for now until they can get enough of a majority again to change the Baptist faith message, which will result in, you know, the utter obliteration of the denomination as a whole, which may be coming anyways. There are large churches leaving right now, and they're explaining why. And it's very obvious that J.D. Greer is way to the left, and who knows what's going to be coming after this. And, you know, Beth Moore's name has been put up for the presidency of the SBC more than once, and That might not happen as long as the conservatives are still around, but if there's a split, then you could see her being made president almost immediately by the whatever split goes left. But her name's out there. But I have said, believe in sola scriptura? All right. Simple question for you. Why are there no qualifications for women elders in the New Testament? There are for men who are elders. There are for deacons who are also men. That's all there. So what are the arguments the other direction? Well, we only just happen to have those qualifications. That doesn't mean that Paul didn't have qualifications for the women elders or the women deacons. They just aren't included in any of the extant correspondence that we have. Which means God did not want to have that in the content of the New Testament. So you have to take a view that what we have in the New Testament is accidental. It's just what happened to survive, what happened to be collected by the churches. There's no spiritual aspect to this. It just happens to be the way it was. And that ends up leading eventually to a degradation of the view of Scripture, which allows for external tradition to then take over and fill in the gaps. That's generally how that ends up going. But I think that if you follow the Reformed perspective, and look, lots of Reformed churches that have the name Reformed in their name have collapsed on this issue. But first, the first thing had to go was not the regulative principle of worship, but the regulative principle of theology. And that is that you need to have positive biblical foundation for positive doctrinal assertions. And so if you want to know what the eldership of the church looks like, you can go to Acts. You can look at the historical reality. You can go to the statement in Acts, I think it's 14, that this is a part of strengthening the churches, whereas the apostle providing leadership in the form of elders, plural, for the churches. Elders in the churches. Not an elder, but elders in the churches. And when you ask what the qualifications were, well, let's remember, again, for liberals, there is a limited Pauline corpus. You may think Paul wrote 13, maybe 14 epistles of the New Testament, but people like Bart Ehrman and more professors in seminaries than you might guess do not believe that Paul wrote the pastorals. Hence, 1 Timothy 2 isn't even Paul. So you can see anybody who buys into that perspective and doesn't believe that this is Pauline and yet calls it scripture. How do you make that work? You make that work by having an external traditional authority in the church that elevates this pseudepigraphal writing, not even, well, it's pseudepigraphal, it's forgery, to the level of scripture. Once you do that, give it one generation, and that system will fall apart. It can't hold together. So part of a long-term strategy for defending a biblical form of the church will include learning the arguments not only for apostolic authorship of all the New Testament books, but against the argumentation that is given and simply accepted in liberal circles as to why you shouldn't believe that these books are written by Paul. And the arguments stink. The arguments are horrific. They are circular to the nth degree. Well, I think one of the clearest evidences is that the form of the church found in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus developed later in history, as we can see by looking at Corinth. In other words, you assume that the church had the most problems had to receive the most apostolic correspondence, and we know from the letter of Rome, the church at Corinth, was not even corrected by that. So you look at the worst case example, extrapolate out from there. And so instead of seeing that Ephesus, for example, plainly had functioning eldership and the whole nine yards early on, continues to have it in the book of Revelation, you ignore that and say, no, this all-male eldership, that develops it later in history, and the primitive period, even during Paul's life, was just, anything goes type stuff. It's Corinth. And so you have that argumentation, the circular argumentation of, well, I'm going to assume that the church looked like this, and therefore anything that doesn't look like this means that it was written later. That's one of the main arguments used in liberal seminaries against the Pauline authorship of those epistles. Then what goes along with it? It's different vocabulary. You have different terminology being used in the pastoral epistles than you have in what are accepted to be the genuine Pauline epistles, such as Romans and Galatians. The problem with that is there's a huge difference between Galatians and Romans. Oh, yeah, you've got a lot of the same vocabulary. The grammar and syntax is different, and there's a reason for that. Paul's really ticked off when he writes Galatians, and he may have written it himself. See with what large letters I've written. Maybe he had an eye problem. We don't know, because it's not all that long a letter, so it doesn't make any sense to understand that large letter as in large. It may have been he wrote it himself. But we know he dictated Romans. He tells us who he dictated it to. So when you get to determine what the starting set of vocabulary is, you can make anybody. If I take Bart Ehrman's scholarly works and compare his popular works, Bart Ehrman did not write both of them. The vocabulary, syntax, and style is different. He has different editors. He's writing to a different audience. He's going to use different terminology. Same thing with the pastorals. If you're writing to your friend, if I write to, if I even had time to write to Michael and David and Andrew and all the guys down in Sydney and Melbourne where I just was about, you know, we talked about church stuff, so let's say I wrote to them and talked to them about church stuff, sort of like the pastoral epistles. If I wrote emails like that, but then they asked me, hey, could you write something for our church on this doctrine? And then you compare the vocabulary, they're going to be different. And so if you make that as the basis for determining authorship, it's obvious. When Paul's writing Romans and he wants this to be an epistle that is read by many for a long period of time in an important church, and then he's writing to his dear brother Timothy right before his death, you really expect those to be identical to one another in vocabulary and form and structure? That's absurd. But that's the argumentation. That's the argumentation. That's what's behind it all. Are we aware of these things? And most of the time we're not. And so we need to be. We need to be. There's more study that needs to be done before you just glibly pop off, Paul said X, Y, or Z. Are you quoting from an epistle that someone's going to come back and say, he didn't write it? And then what are you going to do if you've never even thought about it? You're left sitting there picking your nose. That's not a good position to be in. So I am seeing stuff like that. And I am seeing folks, giving that kind of thing. But I just simply say that aside. Why am I not hearing anything here? The reason I'm not getting a response to this is because the only consistent way from that side to respond is to fundamentally say, yeah, you've got a different view of Scripture and scriptural authority. You seem to believe that you need to have that positive statement in divine writ to have a definition of the central authority structure for the New Testament church. Yeah, exactly. And you're saying you don't. That's the whole point. That's where the rubber meets the road. And so, yeah, there you go. Good old Todd. Todd, you're crazy. So speaking along those lines, you may have noticed a article I posted up today. It's not a long article, but it took me a few minutes to write it. Everybody had been sending me, and last year they sent me, notification about Reese McKinnon. That's his actual name. He now goes by Rachel McKinnon. But Reese McKinnon, a dude who has now won the 35 to 39-year-old women's sprint, track sprint cycling championships 2 years in a row. And there's a picture of him on his bike beating a lady going across the line there. And this guy, just like the woman who's now disappeared because I think she's been arrested, up in Canada, that was suing everybody and their third cousin if they said anything to him at all, even though he's a guy, but he acts like a girl and dresses up like a girl. But I think finally went way too far. And a lot of these people that we end up seeing are, they're doing what they're doing for a purpose, for a reason, to promote transgenderism, the destruction of Western civilization, society, and norms, and everything else. And so we have two stories in the news today that show us the relationship of these things. And they relate back to what we were just talking about Beth Moore, go home. Accept your God-given responsibilities and parameters for experiencing God's blessing. And quit questioning God's right to do that. That's what was behind all that. The one is the ongoing saga in, of all places, Texas. Austin has to have something to do with this. Or San Antonio, one of the two. Where a activist woman is trying to convince her son, 7-year-old son, that he's a girl. When he's not with her, he doesn't act like a girl, doesn't want to be a girl, doesn't dress like a girl, but she dresses him up that way. This is one of the clearest examples of absolute culturally based, politically promoting child abuse I've ever seen in my life. It is horrific. And if it was happening in California, I get it. If it was happening in New York, I get it. Oregon, Washington, the left coast, east coast, I get it. Texas. Unbelievable. A jury just ruled against Texas dad fighting to get custody. This is a divorce situation. And the former wife, her judgment is just. Her judgment will be just. I mean, you put that one together with this dude who he even looks middle-aged. Okay? He even looks middle-aged. Just look at the pictures. Don't blame me. Cotton spandex doesn't hide anything. Believe me, I know. Because I'm not even middle-aged anymore. I'm moving into the old-age stuff. And if any of you are asking, well, why do you people wear it? It's terrible. It's real simple. No, it's not aerodynamics, though it's relevant. And if you've got clothes flapping in the wind, that's called a sail. that's going the wrong direction. You don't want that. So that is part of it, but the primary reason is very, very simple. Cycling is a repetitive motion activity. Your legs going up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. I even have a readout on my Garmin and Strava things. Tell me how many pedal strokes. So I've done a couple 100-mile rides recently. Did one in Sydney. Thank you, David. Poor David. David McKay, he had never ridden that far. I think 125 was the longest, 125 kilometers, and 100 miles is 161 kilometers. So he rode with me, and he made it. But the last part was ugly, and so here was my form of encouragement. David, you're going to do it. Come on, man. You don't want me talking about you on the dividing line. So I'm not really sure that's encouragement as much as it is threat, but it worked. What a great friend. Oh, I know. I know. I know. You know, the guys there in Sydney, they rent me this nice bike, and I did 293 kilometers while I was there. So we did a 100-miler, a 50-miler, and about a 30-some-odd miler, something like that. Not quite 30. That was great. But that was my form of encouragement is, you don't want me talking, because I'm 20 years older than he is. So, you don't want me talking about the guy 20 years younger than I am that didn't make it through the, and so he made it. I'm not sure if he's not permanently injured, but, and then I went riding with Andrew. To me, it feels like yesterday, but it was Monday morning. Well, it was yesterday, but it was actually, you get it. In Melbourne, because I'm collecting places where I run next to the ocean. So I've done it in Durban. I've done it in Cape Town. And so now I picked up Melbourne. And so Andrew took me down there. He's pastor of the church, Hope Bible Church. So we started running. And I need to stretch my knee out. So we stopped. And then, why don't you go on? I'm gonna stretch. And I ended up doing a 10K. And he did a 2.6K run and a 2.6K walk back. And I'm like, man, I hope he hasn't actually hurt that knee farther than it needed to be, just simply to go running with me. Because the other pastor had to go do something else. He's a runner swimmer. He probably would have dusted me. But I was feeling really good, so I did a sub-hour 10K, that helped me to sleep on the plane. So, anyways, the reason you wear cotton spandex is like when you do a 100-mile ride, you probably do. At least, I could look it up, but like 25,000 pedal strokes. And if you are wearing regular clothing, if you're wearing regular shorts, you know what that means? That means that loose clothing is rubbing on your skin 25,000 times. You will be in agony in 10 miles. You will be rubbed raw in 20. You'll be bleeding in 25. What you wear has to stick to your skin, and that's what cotton spandex is all about. And the technology they've got, oh, it's amazing. So, anyway, for those of you who are constantly, you cyclists, there's a reason for it. And you spend 6 hours on a bike, and you will want to have the highest quality cotton spandex possible. Because it hurts you want it to hurt for all the other reasons, not for that reason. That's the one reason that can destroy any meaningful ride. I've had it happen. You get a stitch to go south or something like that, and it is horrific. Well, you can see the pictures of Reese McKinnon in cotton spandex, and he's a guy. He is a dude. He does not look like a woman. You cannot transition. There is no such thing as transitioning. It is a fantasy. Transitioning would require that all your cells in your body move from XY, all the chromosomes, the sex chromosome, go from XY to XX. Even with CRISPR, we can't do that. And even if we ever got around to doing that, this guy, quote, transitioned in his late 20s. That means all through puberty, he was a male. He still is. But he was then, which means bone length, bone density, lung capacity, muscle mass, connective tissue. It was all built as a man. Now, he may have had the surgery and gotten it all cut off, but the machine's still the machine, and it was built by man. It was a male machine and still is. So, oh, goody. The boy beats the girls. Whoop-dee-doo. The reality is, we know that that's the case. I've mentioned before, Martina Navratilova nailed it. She was exactly right. She's a lesbian, but she sees that this insanity is the end of female sports. It is the end of female sports. Because this is the fact. You take the best woman tennis player in the world. And right now, I don't know who it is, to be perfectly honest with you. Haven't kept up with it. But you take the best woman player in the world, and any one of the top 150 men she'll probably not even take a game off him. Blow her off the court. Just blow her off the court. because it's a game of power, and his bones are thicker, they're longer, he has more muscle mass, better connective tissue, and he is going to crush her. He can't have a baby worth nothing. And he can't mother a baby. And he can't nurse a baby. But that's because there's this thing called design. Which, once you lose God, you don't have a basis for believing in design anymore, and that's why we're in this horrific mess. But be aware of something. If you decide to correspond with Dr. McKinnon, he's not a biologist, but he knows how to argue. And if you can't tell where the holes are in the argument, this guy is an absolute advocate, full-on advocate. And he's doing this for a reason. And I feel really sorry for American Don Orwick and Denmark's Kirsten Herup Sovang, because they're the champions. They're the women champions, but they don't get the jersey. They don't get the medal. A dude, beat them. And that's the future. Until our societies wake up and start functioning on some kind of level of common sense once again. That's not happening right now. And by saying what I'm saying, this could be what gets us kicked off YouTube. We know it. We recognize it. They'll never debate this. They will never debate this. Because there are the holes are so gaping and so huge. And the selective use of medical data and statistics is so bad that they would get crushed. So they'll never do it. What you do is you get your people elected to office, you get your people in the judiciary, and then you use judicial activism and you just shut down the other side. That's what we're seeing all across. It's in Europe, it's in the United States, Canada, oh good grief, Australia, oh good grief. It's everywhere. And there's going to have to be a fundamental realignment. Because this system doesn't work. We're watching it come in, and we're watching the people that are being hurt. We're watching the news stories of hundreds of people who have transitioned and become physically damaged as a result, wanting to go back, but they can't. I mean, they're no longer functional. They can go back to dressing and identifying in that way if they want, but their lives sexually, parentally, possibility of parenting, all that, it's done. And that's what makes the Texas boy situation just so horrific. They use the same chemicals that we use to chemically castrate sex offenders to stop puberty. It is unnatural, evil, and insane. Mengele did not think of this stuff in Nazi Germany. And we're doing it, and judges are saying it's good. God's judgment will come against this. It has to. God will not be mocked. God made us this way. And God gave us the ability to understand how our bodies work. And now we're using that understanding to pervert what God made. I keep thinking about I Am Legend. I keep thinking about I Am Legend. And I'm just going, that would be fitting. Yeah, yeah. You want to play with God's creation, ignore the fact that he exists, and try to play God? Yeah, there you go. Let's have some super bugs turn everybody into zombies. That'll do it. Oh, good grief. Yes, sir?
One of the things that has driven me crazy about this whole thing is that it...
I'm sorry. I don't see you.
There you go.
No. This is fine. You need to go back to that.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm hitting the wrong button here. How about that? And then we do that, and how about that? Okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Everybody loves the rich camp.
The
including all the people that are deceived to think that I'm actually mean to you.
Don't these guys have to, for their whole life, take these extremely severe drugs
yes.
to keep this thing going, right?
Yep.
And yet cycling and all these sports have rules against performance-enhancing drugs. What was it, the one Olympian gal, was it cold medicine? Or she took an allergy medicine, and she lost her medal.
Yeah, I know. But here's their argument. Here's their argument. They're taking performance-decreasing drugs.
It still changes them.
I know.
Enhancement goes either way. It's a change.
You're right.
And you are playing games with your body. If we can say what we've said about Lance Armstrong.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that all he did was tamper with his blood. That's all he did. And yet, this is fine.
The
hypocrisy here is insane from head to toe.
Insanity is the only word for it. And I can guarantee you that if there was meaningful medical study being done, you will discover a significantly higher mortality rate and disease rate for these people. We already know there's a much higher suicide rate.
Yeah.
But you cannot tell me that pumping a male body full of estrogen does not do damage to that body long term. Cancer, heart, the whole nine.
Just mentally.
Well,
the
mental stuff, yes, but physically, I can guarantee it. But I bet you could not even get funding to study it because it's politically incorrect. Because it's politically incorrect.
No way.
Yeah, it's just.
Okay, I'm done.
Yeah, it's all connected. It's all connected because, as I pointed out, you know, McKinnon talks about transphobic critics. So if you say, if you hold the position that the entire human race has held until the last 40 years, actually really last 20 years, then you're transphobic, which means there's something wrong with you. And so it's using language to control the narrative, but using words that have no meaning, because there is no such thing as transitioning. So I cannot have an irrational fear of something that actually doesn't exist. I simply have a moral, ethical, and medical, logical, scientific objection to the abuse of the human body. And to the abuse of the way we've been created by God. And to call that transphobic makes you scientific phobic or Christophobic. We can do this absurd weaponized word stuff all we want. And the funny thing is, McKinnon's PhD is in logic. Logic and epistemology. So it's like, really? Seriously? But this is the world we live in. Okay, one thing before I do a little trip stuff. Hey, look what came in the mail today. The Forgotten Trinity updated edition. How many pages is this? I don't think it changed much. 232, somewhere around there. Yes, and it's, that's okay. Bummer. The bio's not right. I thought I had sent them. I mean, they did get the Apologia Church thing right, but they still got me teaching at Golden Gate, which doesn't even exist anymore. Oh, well. At least there's nothing about cassette tapes and stuff about Alpha Omega. I'll let them know about that. We'll get that one thing fixed. But Summer had told me when I first sent the artwork for this, Summer had told me, oh, good, because the other one's so 1990s. And I'm like, but I really like this one. I like the color and the whole nine yards. And so, you know, there you go. This one was only 224. So, there you go. Oh, good. Yeah, there is a scripture index and a subject index. Yay! And lots of notes in very small print. So the new edition of Forgotten Trinity is out. The only changes, really, I added a few paragraphs. There were a couple of endnotes that I had to so often over the years say, look for the end note on this. It's not in the text. And people skip end notes. And if you look, Yeah. How many? What's the notes section? The notes go from 197 to 217. There's 20 pages of notes, and I can't read half of them. In other words, small print, very small print. I mean, there's a lot of information there. And so what I did is I took some of those end notes and brought them into the text. I included a little something on the eternal subordination stuff, but obviously you could. They didn't want a full rewrite that would expand it massively. So I did a few things like that that will hopefully improve it a little bit. But you know, the doctrine of the Trinity really hasn't changed much since 1996, I think, when the original came out. And I'm just thankful that Bethany House keeps books like that in print. I'm thankful the same-sex controversy is still in print. I'm thinking that the same-sex controversy not only majorly needs an update, but needs a whole section on transgenderism now, too. And I'd certainly be willing to do it. Summer says, I'll trade my 90s version for that nice new one. I guess that means I need to bring one of... I only got five. I guess I need to bring one home because Summer's coming down later this week, and she's going to be speaking at ReformCon, as I will. So, microphone again?
There's Twitter. Lauren Holiday just posted about listening to the audio version last night.
Yes, yes. I saw while I was in Australia that if you go to Audible, where I go all the time, yeah, there it is right there. It just came, just now rolled up on mine. Lauren Holiday said, I started listening to the audio version of Gotten Trinity last night. Looking forward to finishing the audiobook this week. The audio version was well done. God bless. Maybe the audio version folks will send me a link to get my own copy so I can listen to it, so I can tell how good it is. Either that or I'll have to burn one of my Audible credits to get it, but they may be listening. Don't be like the guys who did the Doug Wilson book and not even send me one. You know, I can't promote a book when you don't even send me one. Yeah, don't do that. Rich is going, I want one too. Anyways, well, I gave you one of these, but you mean the Audible version. I get it. So it's really nice to have the Audible format there. But especially for a book like this, especially with all the biblical stuff, hard copy is very, very helpful. So new edition out. If you've had on pre-order or whatever else, it's been very, very well used. And hopefully will continue to be used for a period of time. Okay, so we've already gone nearly full hour, and I haven't even taken the time to have certainly not caught up with everything, but haven't told you anything about where we were, and I sort of need to do that. Please don't tune out, because especially those of you who support what? Oh, just the look on your face is sort of like, oh, okay. Oh, okay. All right, good. Setting up stuff for Thursday. Good. We're going to have the Apology Radio dividing line mashup. Especially those of you who contribute to the travel fund. Thank you so much. When I get a chance to travel, I get a chance to meet people in a way that I get to go to churches and really interact with folks, and it's extremely encouraging. Let me, before I tell you about the events, do something just so I don't forget. Could I mention to everybody that there are certain speakers who I will not mention by name who do not stay after a debate for an hour and talk to people and shake hands and sign books and answer questions and take picture after picture after picture after picture. There are a lot of people who do not do that. There have been a few times when I've had to leave right after speaking. Frequently it was because I had to catch a plane. I was being taken to another speaking event. I think once I was sick and I just didn't want to become Typhoid Mary and share my disease with everybody else. But I generally do invest a lot of time in meeting with people. Even after, you know, two and a half, three hour long debates. I'm exhausted. I still meet with people. The people at G3 will tell you that after the Trent Horn debate, there are 350 people in line. I was there for over an hour and a half talking with people after that debate. But there is what? No, not that. But there could I suggest some rules of behavior when you're approaching a speaker who may be at the end of a very long day, may have been now overseas for 2 weeks, because it bothers me. For example, I don't sign Bibles. I don't sign Bibles. I didn't write it. And I don't want to put my name in there. I know other people do. I'm not trying to start a fight with anybody who does. But please just understand, I don't look so horrifically sad that I won't sign your Bible. Just go, okay, no problem. I've had people just whip out a piece of paper. Would you sign that? Okay. If you want to keep in your Bible, I don't care. That's up to you. The point is, I feel uncomfortable signing Bibles. That's all. I prefer signing my books. I've actually had people give me other books from other people, and I don't care. But I just don't want to sign the Bible. So please don't give me the look when I do that. That's happened a few times. Don't ask me to do something that violates my conscience, basically. That's you know. Secondly, when there are 30 people standing behind you in line, I know you want to tell me about your second cousin who served a Mormon mission and how he found the Lord. But there are 30 people standing behind you in line. You may not see him, but I can. I can see the people who have to give up and leave because they've got a train to catch, they've got a plane to catch, they're taking somebody home, whatever it might be. You don't see them. I do. And so when I make a funny comment about the people behind you are about to lynch you, I'm very kindly attempting to suggest to you that you need to be concise. Not just for me, though I would appreciate that, but for your fellow believers who would also like to shake my hand and take a picture and maybe sign a book and ask a brief question. And speaking of questions, could you make them concise too? Limit it to one. And don't do, you know, if I had ever walked up to R.C. Sproul in my younger years, which I did, and said something along the lines of, Dr. Sproul, could you explain what you mean by chosen by God? And he'd go, did you read the book? And if I went, no, he'd simply say, well, read the book. So if you're going to come up to me, please don't ask me to summarize the Forgotten Trinity for you. Read the book. That's one place where George Bryson's line works. Read my book. And then on the other side, if it's 9:45 at night and they're starting to turn lights out, please don't ask me to give you a theological dissertation on the distinction between being and person, especially since I wrote a book about that too, or ask me to go more in depth on something like that. And please don't be disappointed. Believe me, all of these are examples that are used repetitively. Please don't be surprised when you come up to me and say, you know, you did a debate against Roman Catholic once, and you quoted an early church father. What was that about? And could you give me the reference? I have shocked a few people because they actually gave me enough context that I knew what they were talking about. But I've literally had people who referred me to a debate from the mid-1990s. Okay? So from 25 years ago, you quoted a church father that said something like this. What was that reference?
Hey, I get those phone calls.
Yeah. And you're just like, and then when I sit there and go, I don't have a clue. And sometimes, honestly, I've now done 173 moderated public debates. I have probably re-listened to or watched 15 of them. So it's been 25 years since I spoke those words. So what should shock and amaze you is that I would have any clue whenever anybody asks me a question like that. Not the hangdog looks I've gotten from some people that I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what reference you're referring to. I don't recognize the citation. Got no idea. I think most human beings would have the same response. There are a few people who only deal with one subject. So they repeat the same thing over and over again for 25 years. They might be able to respond to that kind of stuff. I can't. It's just not possible. And so please try to remember, I am a human being. One other thing. Oh, please. This will make memes. See my hand? Stay at least that far away. Okay? At least that far away. I'd like another foot, if you would. If you can smell my breath and I can smell yours, you are way too close to me.
So the holy kiss thing is right out. Not happening.
Especially when I'm traveling overseas. Folks, you've got to understand, I am trying to keep from getting sick. You just don't know. I mean, this last January, I lost a month when I went back and taught in Owensboro. And it was the plague class. I ended up with strep throat and all sorts of stuff all at the same time. I lost a month of everything. I mean, just scratch January off the list. And especially if I've got stuff still coming up, debates and stuff like that, please keep your distance. I had a guy, I won't mention where it was, but I had a guy, and I'm backing up, going left, going right, and he's chasing me. I finally managed to get a chair between me and him. That was the only way I could keep him far enough away from me. But he was just in my face. And it's like, keep your distance, sir, ma'am, whoever, please. Don't you understand? I just consider it common courtesy. It's just common courtesy to do that. Keep your distance. You know, I'll shake your hand. And believe me, in my pocket, I have Sonifure hand sanitizer from Hammer Nutrition. Look it up. It's great. I give it away as Christmas presents. My family will tell you in their stockings will be Sonifure hand sanitizer. And as soon as I'm walking out of that place, I'm bathing in it. I have to. It's just, if I don't, I'm dead. So please try to understand if I understand why some speakers, they're just, when I'm done, I'm out the back door and that's it. I'm not going to criticize them for that. I understand. I get it. I haven't had to adopt that yet. My immune system is still fairly fully functional. And when churches rent me a bike while I'm there, it stays even more fully functional, which is what we did in Sydney and then doing the running in Melbourne. Wow, that was very, very helpful. That helps keep you going the way you're supposed to. It's the change that frequently weakens your immune system. But please try to understand, you know, if it's been a whole day conference and this is the last session, I'm brain dead. I'm tired. So one last thing. I'm walking out. I think it was Saturday night in Melbourne. Kofi, totally different context, but all I can think about of as I listen to Dr. Oakley 1689 is the Police song, Don't Stand So Close to Me. Rich is singing it in the other room. Notice he did not turn.
Don't stand.
Okay, he did now.
Don't stand so close to me.
I'm just crushed you know any Police song at all. But anyway, because I'm a Christian, so I didn't know. He said I used to be a heathen. Okay. Anyway, thanks, Kofi. Appreciate that. I should be watching Twitter a little bit more closely because there are some interesting things. Anyways, what was I talking about? Oh, yes, I'm leaving. It's the same day I had the debate with Abdullah Hamimi, which, because of scheduling issues, Melbourne's a beautiful city. Interesting weather, constantly changing. It was really cold there when I ran one morning. They're way much farther south than Sydney. But we had to go in the city to Scott's Church. It's called Scott's Church, to have the debate with Abdullah Hamimi. We couldn't have it out at the theological seminary where the church meets because of a scheduling conflict. So I've had to go into the city. I've had a debate with a Muslim. Again, spent half an hour, 45 minutes greeting people, shaking people's hands. You go on Twitter and find the pictures. People are constantly taking pictures, putting them on Facebook. I think, was there something in between? I don't remember. There might have been. And then we have the evening conference session, which was on Islam. We had Muslims show up, one of which Dr. Bernie Power teaches there. Brilliant guy, by the way. Had dinner with him. Wonderful guy. I reviewed a debate that he did on the Dividing Line a while back. And so let me put you, if you've been looking for some other sources, Bernie Power down there in Melbourne, look for his stuff. Support him. He's a good man. Got great background. Had a great dinner with him at the only Mexican place that I went to when I was down there. Actually, it was actually fairly good. But Bernie Power had been telling us about this one Muslim that they had to get a protection order against because he was so aggressive. And he showed up with about five other guys. And as has so often happened, the Muslims show up. They're looking to be able to complain about something that I said. And I'm talking about reaching out to Muslims. They got up and left because there wasn't anything to respond to. I was accurately, fully responding. I was representing Islam with quotations from the Quran and very accurately saying what Islam actually teaches and then giving a very clear response to it. And so they got up and left, and then they demanded a place to pray and ended up getting into the police ended up being called, not because of violence, because they wouldn't leave. So that was an interesting situation. Nothing came of it. They didn't interrupt. They didn't yell, scream, nothing. They were downstairs. It wasn't an issue for what we were doing upstairs. So that wasn't a problem. But I was aware of that. I had talked with some folks about that. I've been greeting people. I have my backpack on my back. And when I'm traveling, that backpack, by the way, did we get that other one ordered? I bet you didn't. Okay. Anyways, there's a new backpack out that I'm getting because I would be stupid if I didn't, given what I do, given the situations like this. You may have seen it on Facebook. Anyways, my backpack is heavy when I travel. I've got connectors. You know, when I go into a church, if I want to project something, HDMI, VGA, audio stuff, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. I've got a lot of stuff in my bag. Unfortunately, the security guy in Melbourne unpacked it completely and allowed me to repack the whole thing. It's happened a few times. Anyways, it's heavy. And I've already been talking with folks for a long time. I'm walking out of the room. Dr. White, I need to talk to you. I turn around. Here's this young fellow. I knew immediately that this was going to be interesting. Because by the third sentence, Michael Brown's name comes out. And so what he has a word for me that I need to be rebuked for my friendship with Michael Brown. And I'm listening to him talk. And his entire, he never says anything about Michael Brown's belief in God, Trinity, deity of Christ, gospel, justification, penal substitutionary atonement, resurrection, prophecies. No one's going to go there because we're all dependent upon going to his materials to look up stuff. Anyway, nothing. It was all because Michael either will not condemn by name X, Y, or Z, or is friendly toward this person who's friends with this person. It was all the association thing. So his lack of discernment means he's not a believer, and I need to condemn him. So I listened to enough of this, so I've got a good idea. And so I said to the young man, I said, so, and I went through all the list of the things I just went through. Michael's confession of this, 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 this doesn't make any, all of that is overthrown by his lack of discernment. Is that right? Well, yeah. So I took a step toward him. I was taller than him, which is unusual. And I said, I have one question for you. Do you have perfect discernment? Do you have perfect discernment? Now, you can see where I'm going to go here. If I'm going to stand here with my backpack on my back, exhausted at the end of the day, and have any meaningful conversation, then what I'm hearing him saying is he has the standard of discernment that will allow you to have a true gospel profession. So I need to know what this is before we can have any meaningful discussion. If he admits that he does not have perfect discernment, then we can have a meaningful discussion as to how you obtain a perfect level of discernment and how he knows that the level of discernment that Michael has is insufficient to be a Christian. So he can tell me the Holy Spirit is going to give you this level of discernment, and here's how. So I say, do you have a perfect level of discernment? Do you have perfect discernment? He would not answer me. I repeated it. Do you have perfect discernment? Would not answer me. I said, thank you very much. Good night. Turned around, walked off. Interestingly enough, at least two people actually ended up talking to him after I left. They saw what happened. There were still a few people standing around. They saw what happened. They ended up talking to him. And I said, do you know what church he was from? Because I just get the feeling people like that don't go to church because they can't find enough people who are as perfect as they are to be able to go to church with them. So if they are in churches, those are the people who end up leaving churches. Seen it way too many times. I can name names of this kind of perfect discernment people that will only be around people with likewise perfect discernment. So then there's those folks too. And the thing is, this is the second time something like this has happened recently. They always wait to be the last person. You're walking out. The only reason that guy came to an entire 2-hour presentation and then 45 minutes talking to people. So nearly 3 hours of his life, he's stalking me. He's not there to hear what I have to say about Islam. He's stalking me just to deliver that word. And this is happening more often. And so some people say, you know, do you have anybody with you while doing this? I don't, but I probably should. I probably should communicate to churches that if I'm going to be greeting people, then you probably want to have someone that stands with me. A deacon, former football player, current cop, something along those lines. That just stands there and sort of keeps an eye on things because, yeah, that probably would be wise. Yeah.
I've actually done this for you.
Yeah, you have.
And I noticed, was it Zach that was with you in Utah?
Oh, yes. Zach and Luke were there, but Zach has made it his mission in life to make sure that Jeff and I live.
Well,
so, yeah.
I think specifically about G3 2 years ago. And then I go back to the Shabir Ali debate back at Biola.
Yeah.
And Eddie Dalcour standing.
Eddie was there, so was Bo Boyd.
I would say in each of these, if there are people who will do this for you in the future, the key here is to stand behind you so that no one can come up behind you.
Yeah.
and, you know, let you do you with what you can see in your field of vision, and don't let anybody, you know, come up from behind. And then if you get to a point to where you're ready to walk away, that's when you stand in between.
Yeah.
You know, I've always tried not to interfere with you, to get in between. I let you make that decision as to when that security time is. And if you start walking away, you say thank you, and you start walking away, and the guy starts keeping at it, that's when you step in and distract. Don't be aggressive. Yeah. Just be easy about it, and it works.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, that's probably something that I need to start doing in the future. That would just be wise. So that long portion aside, real quickly, we did a excellent conference, at Stanmore, where 3 years ago in 2016, ironically, the conference did in 2016, where I had the debate with Abdullah Kunda, where we had to do it by Skype because he missed his flight. Most people don't remember this, but who was the other main speaker at that conference? It was Jeff Durbin. And, you know, both of us would tell you that in 2016, if somebody had told us that in 2019 I'd be co-pastoring Apologia Church with him, that we would have gone, what? What are you talking about? So that was interesting. Had a good time there, again, meeting all sorts of folks. I met little Angus James, who I had met as a little baby. It is interesting when you meet people over the years and you see the children growing up, that makes you feel older and older and older. And he didn't know who in the world I was, so I had to work a little bit hard. He's a gorgeous little redheaded boy but shy. And yes, the James, that's what the connection is. I had to start showing him pictures of Clementine in January and stars and stuff like that on my phone. And then he sort of warmed up, cause I was doing the grandpa thing and showing him cool stuff on my phone. So, but we had fun with all that. And of course, the guys there took good care of me. I even got to visit a chiropractor doesn't go to that church, but is the wife of a Presbyterian minister that's connected with them and stuff like that. So I got to get sort of fixed up a little bit, which helped a lot with all the riding we were doing. Like I said, they rented me a real nice bike. David, thank you so much. 293K in one week is a lot of riding, and we had a lot of fun during, at least I did. you say you did. I'm not sure, but we'll hope that you did have a lot of fun with that, and had great experiences with that. And then Andrew and the guys down in Melbourne took really good care of me. Great conference where we talked about, you know, the first night there, I'm talking about apologetics and sexuality. So, you know, Australia just recently, profaning of marriage, homosexuality, all the things going on there. You know, they're just a little bit behind us. And then the debate with Abdullah Kunda was really interesting, but I'm not sure how many other Muslims will find it really interesting. And this is why. Abdullah Kunda has a specific Jewish background. That's why I heard of Abdullah the first time, was he was throwing stuff about the Greek Septuagint and the Hebrew text and stuff at people, even back when he was much younger than he is now. And so his take on Paul is not the take that you will get from most of the more Salafi leaning Muslim apologists. It's an interesting take. You need to hear it. But it's not going to be, I think, the standard take that people doing dawah around the world are going to be taking. So, it was obviously very ironic. Abdullah and I have great respect for one another. So it was a real debate with real exchange. It wasn't just a food fight, which is what some people want. If it's not a food fight, then they figure that's not real good. But there was great clarity, you know, in his closing statement. Abdullah confirmed. He said, Trinitarian worship is shirk. And we don't know why God gives the grace of guidance to some people and not to others. He says, I wish it were otherwise, but that's the way it is. So he was open about that. The divide is wide, and we can't just simply say, well, we all believe the same thing. We don't. So thanks very much to Abdullah Kunda for that exchange, and I look forward to stuff in the future with him. And then Abdullah Hamimi took up this opportunity for debate on short notice. And so I was very thankful for that. And he had just, I think 4 days earlier, done the same topic with a fellow by the name of Joash, who I got to meet at the debate. And I guess Joash works with Samuel Green down there, some of the Christian guys doing apologetics down there. I'm not sure if he's associated with Bernie Power or not. Probably. I mean, it can't be all that many of them. They probably each know each other. But so I got to watch a Facebook recording of the exchange between Joash and Abdullah Hamimi. And so I knew that Abdullah would be focusing on textual transmissional issues, which is great. I firmly believe that when you put out the case for the New Testament versus the case for the Quran, that we've got the better of that argument, but we have to be able to explain that. And so it was a great exchange. I think it's been posted. I'm not sure. If not, no, it hasn't been. It was a different one that was posted. It was the Abdullah Kunda one that's already been posted. The other one will be out fairly soon, I'm sure. A fellow drove hours to videotape everything in Melbourne for free. So we thank him for that very much. And so once that stuff comes out, we'll be linking to all of it. But it was a very interesting exchange with Abdullah Hamimi. And I look forward to further exchanges in the future with him. There is I think IERA is doing a Australian branch, and that's what he's associated with there. And they had brought Adnan in earlier. So, but I'd like to have some exchanges with some of the younger guys too, and get to know them, as well. And, so two debates, they'll be available. The one's already up. The other one will be available fairly soon. The apologetic conference, I'll link to that when it's put up. And I'm not sure if Stanmore has posted my talks from the apologetics, their apologetics conference yet or not. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it. Like I said, I only got home a while ago. So I'll be trying to get that information up there. Once again, to everyone who did come up to me, I simply lost track of the number of people who have said that, this ministry has been transformational in their lives as far as providing them with theological grounding and apologetics. And we are obviously deeply thankful when you express those things. There was a couple, by the way, and they're going on mission. And they sort of rushed away. And I felt badly because I hope you weren't offended, because I made the comment. Again, we were going a little long, and so the humorous comment, I don't want the people behind you to get you, and they sort of rushed off. I hope if you're watching, I hope you were not offended, but I certainly pray for the work that you're going to be doing. It was so neat to see people who are now in ministry, and this ministry had a lot to do with the fact that they're now in ministry. That we can never, ever become. I mentioned to Jeff and to Luke and to Zach when we were up in Salt Lake City. When I travel, 50% of the time, someone will say, I found you through Apologia, or I was watching you, and that's how I found Jeff. It goes one of the two ways. We seem to be joined at the hip, apologetically. Maybe it's just the YouTube search engine. I don't know. But again, the number of people who would say things, and please tell Jeff, that we're so appreciative of what doing an end abortion now and you know, this type of stuff. And we do live in an amazing day when I can sit here in Phoenix, Arizona, and provide encouragement and edification for people literally around the world and in a lot of places that I can't go to. And that's been a blessing now for decades. I don't know how much longer it's going to last. But it's been a blessing. We can't expect blessings to be perpetual in that sense. And so let me remind everyone once again, if this material is of help to you, A, right now, support us. Help us to continue not only to do this, but travel fund. I'm going to do another trip before the end of the year. And then trips next year. I'm going to be in Brisbane in early September before our cruise. That's going to make September really, really busy. So there were guys in Sydney that were going, oh, you've got to debate this guy. You've got to debate that guy. Look, guys, if you can set that up before I do Brisbane, so end of August, and you can make it, you can get the commitments to happen, then we can make that happen. But again, I've got to be able to get down there. Travel fund's how we do it. Thank you for your support of that, and continue that support. We really, really need it. And just pray for safety. I mean, you know, abortion doctors aiming guns at people outside abortion clinics and stuff like that. The Lord's in control of all of it. We're in his hands. There's absolutely no two ways about it. So thank you very much for the prayers. Up to this point, anyway, I've remained healthy. But I don't sigh a sigh of relief until about 2 days after I get home. Because that last 14 hours, well, 15 hours, you include the second flight, in the airplane is really where you get nailed, you know? So prayers continue. That would be nice, because we've got Reform Con later coming up. So the next program will be a mashup. It's supposed to be on Thursday, right? So the next program, we're trying to work it out to where we will be able to be live from ReformCon. So we'd have the Dividing Line audience, and then we'd have the Apologia audience, and Jeff will be there, and Luke will be there, and Zach will be there, and Summer will be there. And so I'd love to sort of get everybody involved. We've got lots of stories. I'd love to introduce you to Luke and Zach a bit more. They're sort of behind the scenes a lot. I mean, Luke's on Apology. He's just not as much of a talker as Jeff is. But I'm sure it'll be quite interesting one way or the other. And so that's this week. And then keep an eye out. I'm hoping to have some information maybe by then for my London friends. Just keep an eye out. Might be visiting you again soon. So, as in a few weeks. So just keep that in mind. All right. Don't forget Forgotten Trinity, new edition. I would assume that means that they will update the Kindle. I don't know, but I would assume so because I'd like to have that information in there. So you might want to contact Bethany to see if that's the case. And then go to audible.com and you can get the, Audible version of the Forgotten Trinity now. And for some of you, that's really important. That's how I listen. That's how I read most books while I'm on the back of a bike. That's how I do it. And so we will see you, Lord willing, on Thursday for the Apology Radio Alpha and Omega Ministries Dividing Line mashup. And thanks for listening. God bless.